So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Monday is the anniversary of the day Roger first published his famous thesaurus.
Then on Tuesday, we say happy birthday, Mr. Potato Head.
On Wednesday, the extraordinary stories of the child soldiers who fought in the American Civil War.
On Thursday, how King James changed the word of God.
And on Friday, what did spam emails look like in 1978?
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes every weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, Man fans. Ollie Man here with The Modern Man, and here is what's coming up today.
You never, ever forget the questions that you get wrong, the ones that kind of like mean that you do the walk of shame. They're there seared in your existence.
Fastest finger first, gaming strategy, banter, and ruthlessness. Some of Britain's best quizzes. Tell me how to win your favourite game show. Plus,
I think there's something really sexy about standing under the water. Your clothes cling to you more, they become semi-transparent.
Alex Fox on how to turn the bathroom into the sexiest room in the house. It does help if you have a separate toilet. Plus, our record of the week, and Ollie Peart edges ever closer to that elusive Christmas number one. It's all to come on this edition of The Modern Man. But first, your letters. Tok has been in touch to say he desperately needs to know where he can get one of the onesies Ollie Peart was on about last week. That will be the one with the poo flap, as you may recall. I've asked Ollie for you, Tok. He says apparently you can't get it yet because he was wearing a prototype from Kickstarter. I mean, how more perfectly could one man embody his own feature on the show? He is the zeitgeist. There he is, testing trends. He doesn't even tell us he's doing. So, Tok, sorry if you are desperate for a poo flap. I would suggest sticking with conventional trousers for now. Thank you as well to everybody who got in touch regarding my interview with Martha last week. Man fan Anya, I think, sums it up. She says, Ollie, whilst listening to Martha, I found myself completing her thoughts and sentences. Thank goodness I've not been in her shoes, and I hope to never experience what she was unfortunate enough to encounter. But her thought process was very much like my own, and I imagine like that of many women. I hope she continues to heal and find strength within herself. And thank you for doing that interview in an honest and respectful way. Anya, thank you. And if you still have last week's episode, sitting in your podcast app, waiting to be played, just because you looked at the title and thought, God, I'm never going to want to listen to that. Trust me, try it. Martha is a great person. It's not actually a fundamentally depressing interview. It's an enlightening conversation and well worth your time. Meanwhile, some good news on the fixed odds betting terminals we've been campaigning to cap since our interview 3 years ago with Matt Zarb-Cousin. It is now official after a government U-turn. Betting terminals in bookies will now be capped at £2 from April next year. So it's great to see that's finally happening. And thank you to all the listeners who contacted us on Twitter at The Modern Man to bring that to our attention. But I think on the very same day, actually, as that announcement, it emerged that Kwaku Adeboli, who I spoke to in our episode, The $2 Billion Man, has now been deported to Ghana. To refresh your memory on that one, that is a country he has not lived in since he was a young child. It is simply because he was convicted of a financial crime here in the UK, for which he has accepted his punishment, served his time, presents no risk to others. It is a completely farcical example of the government's hostile environment policy. And the campaigns continue, if you want to follow that, on Twitter, at Keep Kwaku. And we'll keep an eye on it on this show as well, and perhaps return to it again here too. Right, I'm going to cheer up now because this episode, I promise, is a lot of fun. In it, you will learn a shortcut to memorize the order of the US presidents. You will learn which day of the week my birthday, the 12th of May 1981, was. And you'll learn Alex Fox's top tip on how to spice up a striptease. Let's go. Time to talk trends now. It's the Zeitgeist with the man you will know as the bearded guy who drives around in a Peugeot 206 with a purple Soundwave-inspired roof if you live in Dorchester or the greater region. It's Ollie Peart.
Although I don't, because I haven't had my car back yet. They've still got it.
Are they still working on it?
Yeah, because they're going to do a full wrap, and then we're gonna try and sell it.
Now, normally at this point, I would be asking you how you've been getting on with your challenge for the week. However, breaking news, we have a serious update on your challenge for the series.
We have a Christmas song.
Okay, so earlier in the series, Jim from Reverend and the Makers tasked you with writing a Christmas song, and now it exists.
Yeah, I've taken everything that I learned, 12A signature, major key, jingle bells, and I've worked with Philip Mark Anquetil. You remember that guy?
The Australian guy who'd worked with One Direction and Little Mix.
That's the chap.
And for some reason, I don't know what you have on him, is now working with you.
And he took all of the stuff that I wrote, that spaff that you heard as well, and he has compiled it together into a Christmas song.
Now, I just want to just note of caution before I hear it, because if it's good, because he's a professional, mm-hmm. I might be swayed by this. I just want it on the record again that I do think it's a bit bullshit that you sat in a room for 10 minutes and literally just wrote down everything that came to your mind about Christmas, and that is going to give you a writing credit on a song. I admire that technically you've achieved the task. I'm just a bit dubious that you have written this thing if a man on the other side of the world has been beavering away setting it to music.
No, I have a legitimate writing credit on this for that 10 minutes.
I'm not doubting it. You are Jerry Halliwell in this scenario. I'm just questioning whether that's fair. It's the music industry, I suppose, I'm questioning, rather than you.
It's 100% fair.
Fine.
It's absolutely fine.
Okay.
But this song that he sent through, this song that I'm going to play you now.
Yeah. Does it include the lyrics, "This is a time to listen to Christmas, put on your headphones and listen to Christmas," because that was my favourite bit of your brainstorm?
No.
What?
So Philip recorded this on his phone,
uh-huh.
But you have to try and imagine, this is what he said to me, imagine this being Ollie Murs singing it.
Right.
Just have that in your head.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you The Sounds of Christmas, written by Philip Mark Anquetil and Ollie Peart.
Oh, piano led. I like it.
Get out of my lonely bed in the morning. Radio's on about global warming. Rain is belting down on the street. It's beginning to sound a lot like Christmas time. And you're still not mine.
That's a great key change.
Love a key change. You're bopping your head.
Be nearly a year, I keep hearing your voice. Hate silent nights, but I'd have no choice. The light of the fire, mull the wine. Null down a few to forget Christmas time.
I feel like I've heard this before, even though I haven't.
Cause you're still not mine.
I know what you mean. I'm already choreographing the dance moves.
So how am I supposed to move on and forget? Cause all I want for Christmas is inside my head. So turn off the carols, unjingle the bells.
You're enjoying it.
It's good.
You're smiling.
Unjingle the bells. That's a good lyric.
Good lyric.
Don't light any fireworks, it hurts like hell. Cause Christmas reminds me of you.
I like it. It's got a kind of Paul Williams meets Scouting for Girls vibe.
The sounds of Christmas remind me of you.
That's really good.
That is the bit at the end as well, right? So you've got a crush on someone at the office. That's
yeah.
The bit where you make eyes and say, come on, let's have a little kiss.
Oh, the Christmas party.
Christmas kiss.
That's where you make the ill-advised move, isn't it?
It's the Love Actually moment. That's what it is.
So reluctantly, I have to say, in all honesty, you have succeeded at this challenge because the simple task was, can you write a Christmas song? There's a question mark over whether you really have written this, but that is a Christmas song and you were involved in the writing process, so well done.
First of all, there's no question as to whether I've written it or not. I have, and yes, you are right to say that, but we're only halfway through the series, so I've had this fixation on number one.
Some might say obsession.
Yeah,
some might say unhealthy, weird, paranoid obsession.
I think it's a fair one. So remember what I said about Ed Sheeran last week, right? Ed Sheeran, he only sold 85,397 records to get to Christmas number one last year.
Yes.
I cannot get that figure out of my head. That is a completely achievable number.
Well, it might be achievable if you had Ed Sheeran singing that song, but we don't. And we don't even have Ollie Murs. We have Ollie Peart. So how would you sell that many records?
We are part of a podcast network called Acast, right?
Yeah.
And Acast have 20 million downloads every single month.
Uh-huh.
I want to harness that power, that audience, that demographic to help us.
How? You're not going to get My Dad Wrote a Porno or Adam Buxton to be talking about buying this single on their show. So how are you going to harness the network?
Pod Aid.
Go on.
Well, the idea is that we get all of the podcasters that we know, as many as we can get, and we give them a line in the song to sing. And so they all become part of the track. So every single podcaster that you know and love becomes part of this Christmas song. And then we use that power to drive it to number one. Can you just imagine? I'm being serious now. 85,397 and there are 20 million downloads a month. The podcast community, I'm telling you, we have the power.
That's interesting because it would also be something of a press story, wouldn't it, if you managed to circumnavigate all the traditional ways of pushing a single and you were using podcasts to try and get the song into the top 40.
Yeah, and it's been done before, as in not with podcasting, but like to get around the traditional means of getting to number one, so Rage Against the Machine, right?
Yeah, that was like the anti-X Factor number one,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and that was Facebook, basically.
Yeah, it's an online petition.
And no one's done it really with podcast audiences, that is true.
And if there's one thing we know about podcast audiences, they're very loyal.
Yeah, but they're not deaf, crucially.
But you've heard the song.
No. The song's good. I'm not criticising the song that you definitely wrote. What I'm saying is you singing it might still be an issue. And actually, you're saying Pod Aid, so you get all different podcasters to sing a line, and that's fun. I get it. But I'm a podcaster of some prominence. If someone came to me and Helen on Answer Me This and said, sing this line of this song, we'd sing it out of tune and it wouldn't be very pleasant to listen to. And that sounded a bit out of our range.
Well, I thought about that, which is why I got back to Phil and said, can we make it so it's suitable for multiple voices? Can we change it somehow? Can we maybe make it a little bit more comedic, a little bit lighthearted, so that it doesn't necessarily matter if somebody's got a good voice or not?
Like the Comic Relief charity thing.
Yeah, a little bit style. Like a mashup of Comic Relief and Band-Aid, right?
Uh-huh.
And he agreed. And
Bagsy Bono. Can I be Bono?
You can if you want.
But I want to be singing the line, put on your headphones and listen to Christmas, which isn't in there.
I'll tell you what, I will say this now. You can have whatever line you want.
Okay.
But he went away and he sent me an updated version of this track.
Okay.
Do you want to have a listen?
Yes. Oh, it's got some driving production behind it now.
Do you feel like clicking?
Christmas time. It's got the jingle bells.
I think they're chimes, actually. Been nearly a year I keep hearing your voice now. Hate silent nights, but I have no choice now. Light the fire, mull the wine, I'll down a few to forget Christmas time. So how am I supposed to... There's the 12-8.
This is better than the Mel Smith version of Rockin' Around the Christmas Tree already, and that still gets airplay. So turn off the carols and jingle the bells. Let's boil the chestnuts in stew.
Don't light any fire. You were humming! You were humming!
It's great. It's an upbeat, pathos Christmas song. And it doesn't have the word faggot in it, unlike the other pathos song that everyone likes at Christmas.
And
bonus.
And if you remember my spaffing, and this is me, you know, clawing at that writing credit. You know, it was borderline angry, but with a positive
it was,
sway.
Yeah.
And that's what this track is. Merry fucking Christmas.
Yeah, yeah. He's very much boiled down the gist of what you put and put it into something palatable. But maybe there's a genus there. Okay, so what happens next? You want to get a load of podcasters to sing a line each.
Yeah, this is where the real work happens, right? So we need to get in touch with them all. It's a lot of emailing. And basically,
when you say we, this is your baby.
No, you've taken this. Listen,
no,
you are. You said it yourself. No, you're a prominent podcaster. I'm going to have you on this.
Right.
You're a prominent podcaster.
Yeah.
You're very influential in the community. You're going to help me make this happen.
I'm very modest as well. I did not say that I was going to help you
any way. No, I'm telling you, you're going to help me.
Well, how?
Well, you're going to use your gravitas.
Am I now?
Yes.
And what's in it for me? I mean, this is your challenge.
Oh, yeah, that's it. In the spirit of Christmas, what's in it for me? What am I going to get out of this? We're going to give money to charity for it, Ollie.
You didn't mention that.
Well, you know, Pod Aid, I think that we should do something for charity. We shouldn't just, it shouldn't just be some kind of ego trip whereby we all become uber famous for getting to number one.
It's the carrot they dangle in front of everyone when you can't be bothered to do the work, isn't it? It's for charity. You can't say no when it's for charity, can you?
Good to know that you're on board then.
Sure. As I've said all along, I think one potential way of this ending is with you checking into a clinic. But in either case, I'm curious to see how it develops.
Yeah, me too.
Man fans, coming up next, you'll find out how to beat the buzzer and get on your favourite game show. But first, here comes our record of the week, our real record of the week. It's the new one by Tamino. It's called Tummy. And if you enjoy this and you're in London, Tamino's going to be playing live on the 3rd of December. So do check him out.
I'm no longer found. Bugs got a Miami. Bastard in the yard. Spiders on my tummy. I'm no longer found. Sex got on my pride. I'm no longer found. Bastard in the yard of angels. Disabled. I saw someone change the labels. I've seen it. I saw someone change the meaning.
Now, I'm a great believer in serendipity. Very often I just stumble across someone who would be a fascinating guest. You've just got to keep your ears open. And back in May, a man called Jason came to my house having just bought a slimline dishwasher from me for 50 quid on eBay. It was only a Curry's Essentials, but secondhand slimlines are hard to find, so I was giving him a good deal. Anyway, we got chatting on my front drive, and it turned out that Jason is a serial quizzer. He has appeared on 14 game shows, including Pointless, Eggheads, and Countdown. And immediately, this sparked off so many questions in my head. How do you get on so many game shows? How much money can you actually win? Can it be your job? How do you keep your eyes on the prize under pressure? I asked him if, to answer these questions, he could cobble together a little team of his fellow quizzers. He said yes. And now, ladies and gentlemen, let's meet this week's contestants.
I'm Jason Hill. I've loved quizzes for years and years and years. Probably the moment that is the biggest thrill is hugging Ben Shepherd after winning £10,000 on Tipping Point. That was just sheer ecstasy.
I am Julia Hobbs, and my proudest quizzing moment has to be beating the 100 and winning £61,000 on One Versus 100 in 2008.
Hello, I am Will Howells, and I think the most proud moment was probably going on Mastermind, where I did the specialist subjects of the band Suede, which I'd loved for years and years and years, and just getting 15 out of 15 in that first round, discovering afterwards at least that members of Suede were watching and not doing as well.
I presume, Will, the secret to 15 out of 15 is choosing a subject that's actually quite small, so you can learn as much about it as possible.
Yeah, and I would commute to work with a sheet of notes that I'd prepared that listed, you know, the entire discography, what all the B-sides were, who directed the music video, and I would read through that and make sure I knew it all. I got one of my friends who was on the same series to set me questions on Suede, and I set some questions on the American modernist composer Steve Reich for him so that we could sit and test each other. But I won that first match. I went into the semi-final. There's much less lead time in the filming schedule, so you don't know you're going to the semi-final as early as you know you're going to the first round. So then the revision time is less, unless you've been really confident preparing in advance. I didn't have time to watch whatever it is, 37 episodes of Inspector Morse for the second one, so my revision was quite stunted as well.
I think probably what people who aren't quiz aficionados will be interested by or intrigued by is that, of course, we all know there's revision to be Mastermind, because that's kind of the gimmick of the show. You know everything about this thing, no matter how weird the detail. But people might be surprised to know that there's also revision involved in going on a show like Tipping Point. Like, to make sure you get your fastest finger first or you get through the first round, you need to make sure you're abreast of trivia.
Definitely, yeah. You've got to be... The golden rule is to be aware of the rules of the game, and if you can, watch the shows beforehand so that when it comes to the actual recording, you know what to do. And if there's any advantage that you can think of beforehand, put that into practice, then you're going to be one step ahead of other people. And you've got to be ruthless. If you see someone who's a bit flustered and it's you're up against people who are panicking slightly, you just have to be kind of cold and calculated in the studio. Mm. It might make the train journey home a bit uncomfortable if you're with someone who you kind of voted off. But
it always surprises me watching Only Connect, for example, that the third round at Only Connect, the wall, the number of people who stand there not pressing buttons. And there's so much you can do through trial and error. And if you're trying to complete a sequence, you can just work through in a really methodical way. And having that planning in advance and literally sitting down with your team and going, I'm going to be the person who pushes the buttons and tries to finish that while you think about the next thing.
Yeah.
And people don't seem to have had that conversation and thought ahead.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Obviously, the reboot with Jeremy Clarkson, there's a chance of asking the host, asking him for advice, or asking the audience. And you've got to think to yourself, okay, so which lifeline do you use up first? What's going to be the most accurate way of getting to the correct answer? And of course, it's going to be asking the audience. It's the wisdom of crowds.
Yeah.
So just thinking through the process, and okay, so if I was sat at this point, what would I do? And kind of trying to stick with that, I think, because you can easily be sidetracked and then you kick yourself.
Yeah, you've got to sort of have a bit of a strategy, whatever show you're on. I mean, for me, with my biggest experience on One Versus 100, you get a chance to dodge and you get a chance to double after you've knocked X amount of people out of the 100. So it's knowing when to employ your dodges and your doubles as well in order to maximise your prize fund and also your chance of reaching the end of the questions. You know, I had one question which to many, many people would have been easy, should have been really easy to me, a question about the Mr. Men. And on any other occasion, I probably would have known it, but I was this close, like two people away from winning a very big amount of money that would have made a massive difference to my life. So at that point, I just... you know, you sort of forget your name even when you're in that position.
Yeah.
And I just sort of thought, no, I can't take a chance on this one. I'm going to have to dodge it. Mm. And, you know, I got stick from lots of friends and family who were like, you go and get a Mr. Men question right. And I was like, trust me, when you're up there, you just want to stay in the game and you just want to give yourself the best opportunity you can have.
How do you keep yourself balanced, keep your equilibrium level?
I do a bit of yoga and deep breathing. And my first quiz experience was Weakest Link, and I was a rabbit in the headlights. I really was. The red light came on, and I was asked what piece of office equipment kind of is used for kind of making copies of kind of texts and books. And I was going, and you are the weakest link. Before you knew it, the Yahtzee, you're doing the walk of shame, and you're kicking yourself. You're thinking, okay, well, that was because my heart was pounding at 100 miles an hour. I wasn't calm, wasn't relaxed. So I thought, right, okay, then next time I'm going to be super calm, going to concentrate on being relaxed. And it's all about, I think, if you can replicate that sensation of sat at home, relaxed with a drink in front of the TV, that in the studio, you're in a much better position to kind of like have the answer pop in your head rather than being really anxious, which is often the case, because it's a long process. The recording is a long day, and you can be a bit tired, and obviously you're stressed. And if the camera's moving towards you, your heart rate can go up. So it's about working, getting your kind of stress levels down in the studio.
Most of the time, the production team, they do try as hard as they can to make it a relaxed, fun experience. And when those things are going wrong, they'll check up on people, they'll bring you water. I think the format of the shows tends to supply the tension and the fact that people want to win. So once the lights are up and you're in the game zone, whatever else is happening is separate. But around that, most of the production teams will try really hard to actually keep people calm and relaxed.
And the hosts are nice as well.
They cut my favourite moment from My Sandy Toksvig.
All right.
I have, you know, they, when you apply for stuff, a lot of the time, particularly if there's a bit of contestant chat, the production team want to know they can have a chat and there's something interesting you can tell, you know, that time you saw John Travolta in Sainsbury's or whatever, the story you can pluck up. There's just the practicality that when you've got something like 15 to 1, where the length of the show depends on how many questions you got right at any point, if you've got a lot of bants recorded, then you can cut it in and out as you need to make it fit the time slot.
Right.
Yeah.
And so they, I'd put down my party trick, which is telling people the day of the week they were born based on the date of birth.
Amazing. 12th of May 1981.
12th of May 1981 was a Tuesday.
Okay.
I mean, you're going to have to check that.
I will consult. If it's still in the edit, it was a Tuesday. Well done. That's amazing.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Now, I'm not daft, so I looked up Sandy Tuxvig's date of birth before I went on because I thought the pressure of trying to do that in the studio is because normally I do it. What happens is I get drunk and I do it, and then I've drunk too much and I get it wrong.
Yeah.
So I thought I'll look it up in advance and I'll make the facial expressions as if I'm doing it there and then. So she came up and she said, oh, so I was born on this day. And I can't remember what day of the week it was, but I said, oh, it's this day, and did the thing from the rhyme of like, oh, you're a Wednesday's child, you're full of woe. And she said to me, so which day were you born? And I said, oh, I was born on a Sunday, so I'm bonny and blithe and happy and gay. And she went, well, I'm three of those.
So you had the bants.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how important is that when you're applying? Let's go back to before we get into a TV studio, you want to be on a quiz show. How do you go about doing it?
Well, I'm going to just lead up by saying I have a slight advantage over these two people sitting opposite me just by being female. Male applicants outnumber female applicants massively, so I just sort of go, well, I'm a girl. They're going to want me. But it's not just about that, obviously. It's about they want a different mixture of regional people applying. You know, they mix up the regions, they mix up ages, gender, obviously. If you've got something that can make you stand out on your application form, like my funny story, I suppose that you would say, is I was a body double in a BBC comedy sketch show, naked from the waist down. So just
Christ.
So that's one of my stories. That and the fact that I can do the splits and people think it's hilarious. But yeah, that's if you want to put something funny on your form, just you know, make sure it's something that you can talk about as well. You've got to, you know, if you get asked about it, you've got to be able to elaborate, really.
Do you get a research call first?
Yes.
So someone in the office calls and checks these stories with you, do they? Or do they check your ability?
Yeah, there's a lot of that. So, I mean, I think the first thing is if you want to go on a BBC show, most of the time they advertise on the Be On A Show bit of the BBC website. So you want to go on Pointless, just go on there, and other game shows and documentaries where they're looking for people, there's always that information on there. But basically Google the show you want to go on, because the production people want to find contestants and don't want to hide it away and actually are out there looking for people. So obviously if it's an existing show, have an idea about what the tone of it is. So something like Mastermind, or I don't know, on radio, Brain of Britain, and University Challenge, they want people who are just going to answer the questions right. That's their fundamental top thing.
You wouldn't put your stunt bottom story on.
No, you wouldn't. You don't get chat from those contestants.
And so the thing you have to sell to them is, I am really good at quiz. And if they ring up and give you a phone audition, you need to be on it and getting answers right.
Yes, and take the call as well. And don't say, can you call me back in 2 weeks' time? No, you've got to take it.
So they literally, Jason, say, hi, received your application, really interested in including you on the show. When Aristophanes wrote the clouds, is it like that?
There's a little bit of, you're asked, is it okay to ask a few questions? So, and then you think, okay, fine. Find a nice quiet place so that you can concentrate on the questions. Mm-hmm. And I seem to remember I had a litany of questions to be on the chase, and 50, 60 questions. And I was thinking, all right, how well am I doing? And it did okay, got onto the show. But yeah, it's a really important part of the casting process. Good point about making sure that you fit the tone of the show, because I did a Stephen Mulhern show called Pick Me, and it was a mixture of dressing up and answering questions.
Yeah, I remember that.
So I sent in my application dressed as a shark, because I thought, okay, no one is going to kind of
pretend to be a shark. That's high risk, I would say. Like, you're either in or out.
I got the call. Yeah. So it's about making yourself stand out.
But I imagine some of these production teams, when they call you, know you from their previous gig when they're working on another quiz show. Is that an advantage?
So it can be. I mean, sometimes if someone's holding a application forms on file and is, you know, really keen to get contestants, they will dig them out. Or if a runner's worked on one show but you normally have to write on the form what other TV appearances you've had.
So do you lie sometimes?
Oh, absolutely not. And you know, I did one thing where I'd done an application over the phone because someone had got my details from somewhere, and they'd then filled in the form. And because I'm really anal and like keeping lists, I have somewhere on my website a list of every quiz show I've been on. Mm-hmm. And when they sent through the form, they had literally cut and pasted it, because it's formatted exactly. They'd Googled me, gone to my website, cut that list and put it in the thing themselves. But I think for some shows, something like Mastermind, it demonstrates that you're probably a reasonably good quizzer.
Yeah.
But for an entertainment show. I mean, their main concern really is they don't want to have you turn up on two different channels at the...
And that has happened. It has happened. And the Daily Mail would run a story on that.
It does come up a lot within, let's call it, the quizzing circuit. It's lots, you know, there are contestant websites and things and people talk about it a lot. I haven't been picked for this show because I was on that show 6 months ago. And there's no industry standard. There's no hard and fast rule about if you've been on this show, you can't go on another show within a year or whatever. Some shows won't let you on if you've been on the on another show within the last 6 months.
Pointless has a much stronger rule than most of the shows about it.
There are other shows that don't care and they'll have you on if you were on, you know, they'll have you on Tipping Point tomorrow if you were on Mastermind last week, say. It's that kind of thing. But the key is to be absolutely honest about all of your appearances because you will get caught out.
It's a niche issue because it doesn't affect many people, but one of the things...
No, I think that goes for this whole conversation. Yes. That is the benefit of hearing it.
One of the things, if you're applying for the chase, one of the things you have to do, it'll say, like, which chases do you want to face and who wouldn't you want to face? So I wrote in that bit of my form, I know one of the chasers, so I obviously couldn't play him. I remember this chaser saying to me, it amazes him that people don't flag that up. And actually, when he sees a list of contestants, he has to go, I can't play that person, I can't play that person, because I know them, and it would seem really dodgy if people would accuse me of, you know, throwing a
That's
a
an
quiz.
Interesting point. Yeah. So the integrity of these quiz shows.
Yes.
In your experience, do the production teams take that seriously?
There's a verification person at each quiz show who sat there kind of making sure that all the questions are fair. And in 15 to 1, the whole recording process was stopped because there was a question where one of the contestants said, that was really badly worded. It was about a film, whether it was defined as a Western or not.
I heard the story just the other night.
And
go on, what was the question?
It was
about No Country for Old Men being described as a Western.
That's the one, yes.
Yeah. Wow.
One of your opponents told me this story. Yeah,
I could say that's a Western. So what the question was, in the Western...
Yep.
Right, or which Western film directed by so-and-so?
And the contestant thought, well, I was led down a garden path there, and that's unfair. So the filming stopped and there was another question that was offered. So, I really respect the fact that there is real integrity with the process because, you can't say that...
I did, Clever Dicks for Sky Atlantic, and I got to the final of my show... And we had a really, really exciting final that came down to it. It was against the clock and two of us on the buzzer, and it came down to pretty much the last second. And they cut us off and cut my final buzz off ahead of the clock. And there was a real panic in the studio of, we think we didn't give you enough time and it would have made a difference to the final result. And there was genuinely a half-hour chat between the production team and the adjudicator on what should happen. And they came to us and said... Do you think the two of you could recreate exactly what you did? Because it's against the clock. You can't just slot something over the top. It's all tied together. And so in the end, we scrapped that whole final and literally just did it again. I got thrashed, so I looked much worse than I had the first time. But I think it goes back to, I don't think it would have been the case 30 years ago, but I think there's been enough scandals from the phone polls about Blue Peter Katz or whatever over the years that there's now they know it was really damaging for the brand if anything... Yeah. Got out.
Well, this is it. And the coughing major on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire is the most famous example, which led obviously to a court case. But that never, it seems to me, would have come to court if it wasn't £1 million of ITV's money at stake.
I mean, there was a really weird story about from 15 to 1 back in the William G. Stewart days, because there were rules about whether you could go on more than once. And literally a guy got himself a fake name, got himself a disguise, and went back on under a different name, and viewers
called in,
and I think Julia will probably know better. Did he get booted out of the final in the end?
I think he did. I think he was banned from going on again. And I think
there wasn't even big money on that. You could get a Greek bowl.
Yeah, it was a Greek relic or something.
What is the most coveted prize that isn't money? I mean, obviously, you'd all like to win £1 million, but what is the equivalent of
it? It's got to be the Mastermind Crystal Bowl,
Wow, unanimous decision on that. Okay.
I guess it's because even though it isn't really a pure form of quiz because of the specialist subject element, it is still such a kind of... It's long-running, it's iconic, it's one-to-one with the host, and so... It feels like a much more pure version. There's no gimmicks about arcade machines or
opening boxes or anything. It's just quiz questions. And if you answer the most quiz questions in the same amount of time as someone else, you win.
Yeah. How do you guys feel about Deal or No Deal, which you just made reference to there? Is that a quiz?
No.
I mean, it's just luck.
No.
Would you like to go on it?
Not really, I don't think.
So you're not in it for the game, you're in it for the answers.
Deal or No Deal would just be about the money and maybe having your face on TV for an hour. But the thing that would put me off Deal or No Deal is you used to have to commit to a week
bit
and be away with I'm not the most social person, being away with a bunch of strangers in a hotel for a week.
In Bristol.
And actually that is the problem with some shows. If they've got a complex format where you might get through to the next round and go back and back. There was a show some friends and I looked at auditioning for, which basically wanted you to commit to spending a week in Belfast without knowing...
That wasn't the prize, presumably.
That wasn't the prize. And I mean, I've never been to Belfast. I would love to have a trip, but what I don't want to do is take 5 days off work to make the life easier for a production company on a show with no money in the prizes, if I remember.
Well, that was essentially my experience of being on something called The People's Quiz in 2007.
Go on.
Which was, it was a national lottery show, so it was over a number of Saturday nights. So you had to, play your way through every week. To end up in winner's row and then into the final. And I did manage to get into the final, but I was the last person to get second last person to get into the final.
Uh-huh.
So I was there for the entire run and did spend probably the best part of a week sitting in a green room at TV Centre, which was fine up to a point. And then you kind of go, just want to just kind of get on with it now. And we were put up in a hotel in Acton, and it wasn't the most glamorous of surroundings. And yes, I'd taken time off work, and no, I didn't win, but I did have fun. I had it was quite a nice week, and I got to answer lots of questions and show off, which is basically what quizzing is all about.
But the longer you spend with the people you're playing against, I don't know whether this is kind of an insider tip, but I sometimes kind of take along a quiz book and I read out questions in the green room. And then it's a way of working out who's really good. And you can surreptitiously think, oh, okay, this person is kind of like, you need to kind of like watch out for them.
So let's talk about that. One thing, sort of filling out the form in the right way, having the banter. You guys all know each other through the London Quiz League?
Quiz League London.
So you're quizzes and that's your hobby.
Yeah.
But how do you, give us a life hack here, how do you actually revise to be on one of these shows, to have the appropriate knowledge of all the trivia you need? Is there any shortcut?
I don't really revise, because general knowledge is general knowledge.
Yeah.
And it's
an interest in the world.
You've never looked at a Wikipedia article of capital cities of the world?
I've done that. I use Wikipedia occasionally. I do look things up. I have
That's
gaps.
Revising, though, isn't it? Because I haven't. I haven't looked at that article.
I think it's revising if you do it with a particular purpose to learn. But if it's just a general interest, having a little bit of an interest in a lot of different things is a very good place to start.
So I actually am pretty good on pop music, films, popular culture. Like when I'm watching those shows, I pretty much get those questions right. My downfall, sport, never had an interest
Same
in sport.
Here.
Terrible at sport.
So, that's reassuring to hear. So I could enter a show and still get through to the final knowing about sport?
Yeah, you can. And because again, the more quizzes you do and the more quizzes you watch, even if you're not going on them, if you're watching them, you'll see and hear the same sort of things come up time and again,
American
maybe in slightly different
president.
Ways.
Thank you. This is what I want to know. What are the things?
American presidents. Signs of the zodiac, wedding anniversaries.
They're what we call chestnuts in the quizzing world. They come up all the time, and they're things that you expect quizzers to just kind of know like that straight off the top.
Give us
of their
a chestnut.
Heads.
Give us a chestnut.
Weird things like lutetium, the element, is named after the old name
for
Paris.
Name for Paris. Yeah,
that's the kind of thing no one just knows in the street, but
quizzers just know it because it comes up all the time.
Amazing.
Yeah, Latin names for elements and things like that, and Greek names for elements, and they do come up time and again.
Okay, when you say presidents, which era do you need to know? Presumably pre-Clinton.
Probably everything, really. It's
Now, loads of Alexander Hamilton related questions now, but you can also revise by listening to the soundtrack.
Yeah.
You listen to the cast recording and you learn about the fact that it goes Washington because he's in it at the beginning, and then John Adams replaces him, and then Thomas Jefferson comes on, and you can learn all that from a musical.
Yeah.
And then when you're trying to remember, you can use lyrics instead of trying to just know a list.
So memory tricks are important for trying to recall the information.
I mean, I've got a little thing for remembering the signs of the zodiac, where it's like visual mnemonics, as in, I think beginning of November, kind of fireworks, and then there's a big scorpion in the sky, Scorpio, kind of November, and you can use that to kind of like enhance your list learning. But I'll say now, it's
it gets you so far. But when I was on Pointless, there was a couple called Solid Gold, and they sat in the green room and they had their little green book and they were kind of revising tests. They didn't speak to any of the other contestants. And then the first round, countries ending with Stan, S-T-A-N, they looked at one another blankly. We haven't revised geography. It's like, well, yeah, you can kind of revise.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of luck involved, and there's going to be stuff in the show that you haven't prepared, so you just got to run with it.
It is. I mean, it's good to, if you're serious about it, it's good to track down those basic things. Mm. I mean, my other thing for presidents is I just know, I don't learn all the numbers. I know Reagan was 40, and I know who comes after. So someone gives me a number, I have enough time to count up.
Yeah. See, I vaguely did that for my literature degree, now I think about it. I knew that Shakespeare wrote Hamlet in 1600. I kept that on me, and then I thought, roughly, where in his canon would this play be? Would he have written it before or after Hamlet?
Shakespeare, if you want to know Wars of the Roses history, knowing the Shakespeare plays from Richard II through to Henry VIII is basically a really good way of... I know my order of that by having gone to the Globe and watched Henry IV.
Okay. Now, Julia, you went beyond being a contestant.
I did, yes.
You are now a professional question setter.
That is correct.
Like, well, actually your day job is
it
that?
It is actually my day job. I turned my hobby into my job.
Tell us how.
Well, after having been on One Verse 100 and winning £61,000, that was actually recorded 9 days after I'd received redundancy from my previous job. I was given redundancy notice on the 31st of January 2008. And on the 9th of February, I went to Maidstone, recorded this quiz show, sat through three recordings, didn't get picked to be the one. The final show of the day, I played my way into the last 18 and was chosen to be the one to get on stage, chat to Ben, answer questions and find myself beating the 100 and winning £50,000 bonus on top of what I'd put into my prize fund myself by answering questions. So, hooray me. That was great. Lovely day. Thank you very much. And after that, I pretty much had a year off work.
That's brilliant.
Thank you.
I mean, that's already a great story.
That's
before
the dream.
Yeah, that's the dream. I had a year off work, went and did some travelling, went to South America, you know, had a lovely time. And during the course of being a contestant on a previous show and on One Versus 100, I met a gentleman called Luke Kelly, who was one of the producers. And I had said to him, I'd been quite interested in setting questions. How would I go about that? Is there any way I can get into it, etc. I had done a little bit of question setting on the side from my normal day job, which at that time was working in a financial ratings agency in the city as an admin. So I'd done a little bit on the side and I sort of wanted to explore it a little bit more. Anyway, I had a whole year off work. And towards the end of that year, Luke got in touch with me and he told me he was working on the new version of Going for Gold.
Did that happen?
There was a revisited version on Channel 5 live at lunchtimes. It was presented by John Suchet and it was live at lunchtimes and there was a viewer phone in Element and so on, and he was working on the new version of that. Gave me a call, asked me if I was interested in setting some questions because they needed a question set to start in the new year in January 2009. So I sent in a sample set, had an interview, and they took me on. So, and I've never looked back. So now I have been a question writer. I worked my way up through assistant producer, and now I'm one of the questions producers on The Chase.
Amazing. But that means presumably you can't enter a quiz now.
I can't go on quiz shows anymore. Yeah. I can still. Last year I had to go on Only Connect.
What do you mean you had a go?
Well,
you were on.
Well, we were on Only Connect. My team made it to the semi-final of Only Connect, the last
series.
That's
allowed because that's a bit more cerebral.
That's allowed because it's, well, there's no cash prize, so there's no big conflict. And I didn't know any of the production team. Similarly, Mastermind, I could have a go at that theoretically because there's no cash prize and I wouldn't necessarily know the question setters or the verifiers. But basically, no, I'm not allowed to go on anything.
You could be a phone a friend,
now.
Though.
I could be a phone a friend, yeah. For people on Millionaire, if you find yourselves going on Millionaire, I could do that.
Yeah, actually, I'm going to keep your number for that purpose. All of you.
But no, I'm not allowed to go on shows anymore, which is, it's good and bad because I'm a bit envious of the people now that go on shows and women. Like 15 to 1 was the very first quiz show I ever went on.
Same.
In 1997, back in the William G days, that was my very first time going on a quiz show. And that was what made me think, this is great fun. I can do this. I really enjoyed it. And the next one was The Weakest Link and so on. So I just kept going on quiz shows.
So hold on. When you say you can't revise, you're being a bit disingenuous, aren't you? Because you spend all day presumably repeating often the same formula of making a question.
Yeah, I do.
You could tell us right now what we should be looking at to revise to go on The Chase.
Obviously, I do that now. My job is looking at questions. So no, technically I don't really need to revise because things come up all the time.
No, but what should I revise if I want to be on the chase? Where do you get
I'm
your questions
sure
from?
I can tell you that.
How do you come up with a quiz question?
What I tell people when they ask me this very question is that everything you see, everything you read, everything you watch on TV, everything you hear on the radio, there are questions everywhere if you know where to look. So, you know, you'll see a poster on your tube journey to work. You might see a poster for a new production that's on in the West End. Just have a look at the poster and then you can write a question. But for example, the other day I've seen the poster for the Bob Dylan exhibition at, I think it's the Hayward Gallery. Can't remember. No, it's not the Hayward Gallery. It's somewhere in Soho.
This obviously wasn't the question.
No, but it's called Mondo Scripto. And, you know, you could write the question, Mondo Scripto is a 2018 exhibition of work by which Nobel Prize winning singer-songwriter, for example, that kind of thing. And you've got to sort of then put in a bit of context to the question so that there are clues there. It's one of those things that's kind of, it's hard to define, but when you're actually doing it, you do just do it and you sit there and things come to mind. I mean, you start with what you know. Instead of sitting in front of a computer screen going, oh God, what can I write about now? Think about a fact that you've heard that has interested you. Have a look for a source that can back that up. Write the question around it. And then that source might take you into other places where you can find other facts about other interesting things.
Which Oscar-winning composer wrote the theme to Going for Gold?
Hans Zimmer.
There we go. I'm in a room full of quizzes.
And actually, that song has about six verses that you never, ever heard on the show itself. We had, when I worked on the new version, we had the theme tune, the words to the song, on the stuck to the wall in the office. So, yeah.
And some shows you're against the clock, but some shows you're not. You have as long as you want to come up with the answer. How long have you actually left it whilst you're racking your brains?
I think with Eggheads, I was in a charity team against the Eggheads, and it was a tie-break scenario, batted back several questions, and then we were really befuddled by a question which was which Guardian writer wrote Bad Science? And what I kind of looked at my team members, they looked at me, we scratched our head.
I know that one.
Yeah, and we scratched our shoulders, kind of like we rubbed our temples. It's fine, you can think about it. And I thought, is this the answer deep within my soul? And I kind of like kept digging. And you know, when you're digging, you're thinking, it's nothing here. And I kept thinking, is it Gilly Cooper? No, it's not Gilly Cooper. And then kind of like just had to say, look, we just don't know. And it was, we had to kind of shrug our shoulders, but we must have been like 10 minutes or so on this one. There was no audience, so we could take our time. And at that point, we knew that the game was up and we were going to lose. So,
do you sometimes, I mean, your most high-level fails, do they haunt you?
You never forget them. Ever forget the questions that you get wrong. The ones that kind of like mean that you do the walk of shame. They're there seared in your existence kind of for forever.
You're all nodding. Well, what was
I
yours?
I had something I didn't realise until it was over. And by over, I mean 6 months after it happened, because I was on 15 to 1, got to the grand final, which kind of surprised me. This was in the Sandy Toksvig era. So, unlike the Grecian urn, there was a £40,000 prize in the grand final, which is enough to take a year off work and just do whatever you want. And so I got to the grand final and went, this is great. And then somehow I got to the final of the grand final. And the format in the grand final of the grand final is different from the rest of the series because it's all on the buzzer. So in the rest of the series, people can nominate you to answer questions. And if you don't know that question, you're out. But in the final of the grand final, it's entirely down to you what you answer. And I was like, do you know what? I'm actually quite good on the buzzer. I don't know as much as some other people, but I can get there faster. And suddenly I got into this, oh my God, I could actually win 40,000. I came on because I like this show. And I was sitting really nervous before we went back in, going like, I am this close to winning this money. And we went in and we started and I was buzzing ahead and building up. And then in the pressure of it, I gave two stupid answers in a row doing that, which meant I was down to one life. And suddenly, because if I got lost that life, I would be out. I couldn't take as many risks, but I was still going through and going for stuff. But just, you know, an extra fraction of a second slower. Got to the end. Didn't win the 40,000, but I was about 30 points behind. And really just these two questions, which were about vertices or corners on a... I'd got confused about vertices and corners on a cube, and I'd got confused between mojitos and margaritas. in buzzing, like I said, rum instead of tequila or vice versa. And I still keep getting that wrong in Quiz. But at the end of it, I was so close. But what I didn't realise until months later, I just went into a really complete funk. Like in my daily life, I was really down and I didn't know why. And it's because I'd had this, suddenly was so close and literally had started spending the money in my head, which is a really bad idea. And it was only, and they also say to you, don't tell anyone what happened because we want to keep it all under wraps. We want it to be a surprise at the end.
And it wasn't on telly for 6 months.
Well, so it didn't get broadcast for about 6 months.
Oh, so you had 6 months of feeling depressed and not realising.
Yeah, not realising that's what was really, and it's a weird thing to be at the core of it. But once it was broadcast, everyone knew about it, everyone could watch it, everyone could go, do you know, you did really well, you got to that, and you could openly chat about it. And suddenly I felt this thing lift, and I was like, that's ridiculous. I went and did a thing I really enjoyed doing, and actually this weird kind of low-level melancholy that's been following me around for this period, it's just down to that, like, really punishing myself for being too keen. So it's not all fun.
I mean, Julie, I know you also work on the production team of one of these shows. Do you guys think about that? Because whatever the money is, if it's a life-changing amount of money, which for some people could be anything upwards of £5,000, do you think sometimes the jeopardy is too high for people?
For the contestants, yes. I have seen people just fall apart in front of the camera.
Me
when
too.
It's awful to watch it when you think that they're going to be fun and excited and bubbly, and they start off in that way, and then, for example, on The Chase, you know, they might be filing their cash builder when they're having their little chit-chat to Bradley. And Bradley's very, very good at making people feel at ease. He's, you know, very comfortable. He'll look after them. But then they'll get to the table and all of a sudden you can see the life drain out of them because they're facing the chaser and this is real money at stake. I think in the cash builder, it's kind of they're building up their pot. So, you know, they're trying to answer as many questions as they can correctly and get a basic amount to start with. But then suddenly it becomes they've got to choose an amount to play for, and it scares people.
It's
an
unreal scenario situation. And when you start asking yourself, what is this? I'm standing in front of someone who's a household name and answering questions. Mm-hmm. And the moment you start thinking, this is weird. This is why am I here? What's happening? Mm. That's when the kind of the collie wobbles and the yips can kick in. And I've seen contestants, again, breeze through the early rounds and they're in the lead. And then and suddenly it's like they realise, oh, I could win this. Oh. And then suddenly the confidence drains from them. And then the moment's lost. And that was a lesson that I kind of taught myself, is like, don't get too carried away with things. And it's a football thing as well, isn't it? It's like, you don't get too carried away if you're winning 3-0 because the other team can come back and you lose 4-3. It's about trying to be as calm as possible, but that's not easy. It's not easy.
And the thing that's changed now because of technology is you don't have to go to a TV studio to take part in big money quizzes. There are apps now, aren't there, where you can play along. Yeah. Do you do those too?
I've worked through them. Basically, so as each one's come online, I've kind of tried it out.
So HQ is the one most people have heard of.
Yeah. So I played HQ for a bit, but in order to win on HQ, you have to get every single question right, and I never managed to do that. And I knew people from the league who were winning from time to time.
Yeah.
And then Cash Show came along, and Cash Show, you started to win money from the sixth question, smaller amounts, but the trick with that, really, which isn't something you can replicate now, is when there was fewer people playing, it was divided by fewer people. So when I started, if you got to the sixth or seventh question, you could maybe win a couple of quid. And once more people signed up, you could win a couple of pence.
Yeah.
So early on, I think I got about 150 quid out of Cash Show over a few weeks because I was doing quite well. You didn't have to get to the end and there weren't loads of people playing it. So the prize fund was split between fewer people.
Yeah.
Then another one came along. There was another one where you had to get all 12 that I've forgotten the name of. And I've kind of, the amounts now that are so low, unless it's like a big money HQ, there can only be one winner. We go on to the end thing. And I just go, I'm never going to be the one winner of that.
Why aren't you ever going to be the one winner? Why can't you be the one winner? You won Mastermind.
I could probably fluke it, but the chances of it and the amount of time I'd had to put in, I think I'd rather just spend it doing other stuff.
Yeah. It is an interesting format because with HQ, it's 12 questions, and if you get all questions right, you get a share of the pot. Sometimes it's £1,000, sometimes it's £5,000. Very occasionally, it is playing to the lads that to just one person is left.
And the first couple of questions are really noddy questions that, that anyone could ask. And
noddy then, questions?
Yes. Yeah. Who's the Queen of England at the moment? Is it Queen Elizabeth?
I think the first question today was on HQ was St. Nicholas is associated with which time of year, Easter, Christmas or...
Okay.
And it reels you in. You think, all right, okay, for if all 12 questions are like this, I'm going to breeze through.
I'm just curious etymology-wise, though. Noddy. As noddy. In, like, Enid Blyton's noddy?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
That's an accepted quizzes term for an easy question, is it?
Or a gimme, I guess?
Gimme is
what's a gimme?
A gimme.
A gimme.
Anyone, give me that question, I'll get it. Yeah. Anyone will get it right.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Give me a point. Basically, give me a point.
Yeah.
Right.
By answering the question.
And, then it gets to question five or six, where it's sometimes an unexpected answer. I think there's something along the lines of recently, which country has got most motorways? Is it Germany? Is it Spain? Is it the UK? And a lot of people would instinctively go, oh, it must be Germany.
Yes.
And I think it's Spain. So that kind of lots of people drop out because the obvious, the inverted commas, obvious answer is the wrong answer. And the question setters are quite clever in that they will kind of, when you get to question six, question seven, it'll be the non-obvious answer.
Yeah. And as you get into that psychology, you start to go, I don't know this. So is it going to be the interesting fact or is it going to be the obvious answer? And you're making that judgment rather than what do I think is right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
From a question setter's point of view, that is quite a naughty thing to do. And it's not something we tend to do.
Because it's a trick question
world.
In effect, isn't it?
It's a trick question.
After our questions like, what is the distance between the Earth and Saturn, and the three options will be just three long strings of numbers.
Yeah.
And it's not a quiz fact that anyone would reasonably know.
Right, now that is what happens on those fucking pub quiz machines.
Yeah.
And that really annoys me.
It's like a stopper question.
Yeah.
Yes. There's a phrase for it as well, a stopper question.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because that's, I at university, was quite into my pub quiz machine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've got a couple of quid to spend in the evening, literally a couple of quid, and that's what you do, because you get a decent amount of entertainment out of it. You get your friends around. And I'd play Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, I'd play Hangman, and I'd do all right. I could always make 4 quid, but when it got to the question that could win me a tenner, it was always something like that that you literally couldn't possibly know the answer to.
Yeah. And you know, you can get lucky. People obviously do.
An impossible choice, really, so you can.
Yeah.
So, but do you? Have you ever won money on a pub quiz machine? Because if you haven't.
Yeah. That was my student union bar. I'd be down there on my own at the quiz machine.
So was I creating this illusion of friends around me.
But I do think with the quiz machines and with the apps, that is actually, and we were saying about watching TV as a way to revise quizzes. You know, watch quizzes and the same things come up. Actually, even if you're not winning on something like HQ or on a pub quiz machine, the kind of questions that come up, unless they're the really badly written ones like that, are useful quiz revision. And actually just getting your brain in a cycle where you're getting used to answering things quickly and you're recalling facts, it's practice.
Yeah, absolutely. Like pretty much anything in life, practice makes perfect. Yeah, you can, the more you do, the better you get.
Julia, Will and Jason from the Quiz League of London. And remember, if you think you have a story or an experience worth sharing, please do email us via our website. I don't always have the time to respond to everything personally, but we do read it all. Visit us at modernmanwith2ns.co.uk and click feedback. Next up, Alex Fox, We'll Get Wet. After this.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Time to talk sex. It's The Foxhole with Alex Fox. How are you doing?
I am spiffing and ready to talk about spaffing, Ollie.
And what have you been up to this week, spaff-wise?
I took an HIV test involving just a tiny pinprick of blood as part of a documentary I've made about modern HIV testing, management and history for BBC Five Live.
Had you ever done this particular kind of test before?
I actually hadn't. I test regularly for all types of STIs, including HIV. This one was the most modern type of blood test for home usage. It comes in a little pack that kind of looks like a DVD sort of case, that size. And inside, it looks like a little tiny box that contains a needle. It's almost like a stapler for your finger, so you never have to see the needle. It makes the possibility of doing it wrong or having an accident very, very minimal. It's hard to fuck it up, basically. And then you get a result within 15 minutes. If there's just a single line, it means you're negative. If there are two lines, it means you're positive. And there's loads of support if you do get that latter result. There's a WhatsApp number so you can chat to somebody straight away.
But they don't send you a free bottle of champagne if you get the negative?
No, they don't. Although I did feel like having a drink afterwards because my first test was actually inconclusive. There were no lines on my test. The blood had not mixed with enough buffer solution. It also had congealed a bit on my finger. And the test couldn't give me an exact answer on my status. Ollie, I have to be completely honest with you. It's my job to know that nowadays, a positive diagnosis in 2018 is not what it was in the 80s. But even knowing all this, I feel a little bit of shame admitting this, but I think it's important for me to be honest. I did feel some trepidation. I felt a little bit of fear when that test was inconclusive. And there were then another 15 minutes while I did a second test, which thankfully did come up negative for me. But I think it was really crucial for me to go through that because it's given me a better understanding of why some people might not test because they're afraid. And I have further work to do with my colleagues at places like itstartswithme.org to recognise that there is still fear attached to HIV, even knowing what we know now, and that people might need their hand held whilst they put their finger on that needle.
Okay, time for our listener sex question of the week. It comes courtesy of an anonymous man who says, "My wife wants to have sex in the shower, but I'm over a foot taller than her, so we really struggle. Is there anything else fun that we could do in the bathroom, preferably with water, instead?"
Well, for a start, as somebody who makes a hobbit look tall, I can assure you that it is totally possible to have comfortable penetrative sex in the shower without any other additions, so long as you pick a position that works. Generally, if the woman faces the wall, provided it's not too slippery a surface, and you go in from the rear, it will require you to crouch a little bit, but it doesn't place as much strain on the body as face-to-face sex, then that is doable. But you can make it a hell of a lot easier by using props that give you something more to hold on to. Now, none of these things sound sexy.
No, I mean, when you say props, I always think Tommy Cooper.
There is a range actually called Sex in the Shower.
Oh, right.
Of suction cup handles and footrests, and they're also designed to be removable. So rather than having to have something fitted in your bathroom permanently, which might be a problem if, say, you live in rented accommodation.
And are they in sexier colours than mobility aids? Like, do they come in blacks and sparkly things rather than just that white sort of, you know, nursing home look?
All the ones I've seen are white.
I've created a niche there. Yeah. Sexinthesexyshower.com, please.
Do you remember last season we spoke about a rather attractive transparent sex stool called the Kaziti?
I do, yes. 1 minute it's a makeup table, the next minute it's a cunnilingus aid.
Precisely. Well, I think that would work really well for shower sex. You would have to put it on a non-slip mat, but that means that the male partner could sit down and then his female partner could straddle him. The seat is totally waterproof, really easy to clean afterwards, and it would look not out of place at all in a bathroom as it is. So that's another option. But if you don't want to have penetrative sex, if that is proving too difficult, there's loads of other things you can do. Probably the most obvious that doesn't require you to buy anything at all is oral sex. He can go down on her, she can go down on him. There are also a variety of toys specifically designed to be used in the shower and the bath, and there is tons to explore here. There's a fantastically named brand called Drops of Sweden H2O, and they do a rabbit that attaches via a shower hose to your taps. You need the right plumbing scenario for it to work. But not only does the shaft...
Love the idea of calling British Gas around to look at this. All right, mate, you want one of the rabbits, yeah? That'll be extra. Plus that.
But anyway, I digress. The Drops of Sweden rabbit looks like a normal rabbit vibrator, and it does have all those vibration and pulsing settings. But rather than the ears being a clitoral stimulator that uses the motor, it's a little spout that pulses water against the body. And there are many, many women out there who will have experienced their first orgasm by using the shower head in the bathroom. And for a lot of folks, that really, really gets them off. So this combines modern technology and vibration with that kind of old school stimulation. And it allows you to work in temperature play. You can make the water hot or cold.
And is there an equivalent for the gentleman?
Oh, yeah, there's a company called Bathmate. A lot of their toys are also designed, they're kind of penis pumps. So they are sold as devices that can temporarily or even long term, so they argue, make your penis bigger. As we've discussed in the past, Ollie, I think that's a fruitless task. I think you should work with what you've got. Although, you know what, if you want to look plumper in your thumper for a while, then knock yourself out.
And this scenario of bathroom sex, shower sex is quite common, isn't it? Why is that? Like, I wonder whether it goes back to like communal showers people had when they were younger, or whether it's sort of the thrill of those elements, you know, the fact that, you know, air and water. And
there's also the idea that it's just a different room. We speak so often about how putting sex in a different place can make it feel different. And then there's all the sensory aspects of hot and cold water and steam and looking at yourself in the mirror and the acoustics of a bathroom, making your orgasmic moans and groans sound different.
I suppose it's a place that you are naked as well, most frequently, that isn't your bedroom.
It's also
usually by yourself.
Yeah. And it's also one of the few rooms in the house, other than a bedroom, where it's common to have a lock. So this is, the bathroom is a place that affords people privacy if they have flatmates or children. It's a good place to go and grab 10 minutes together.
Yeah, it's also, I kind of forgotten this when I was asking the question, it's also a place teenagers typically go to have a wank, isn't it, for that reason? Like, you know, if it's not nighttime, that's where you're going to go, isn't it?
Yes, I can't argue with you on that one. And I just wonder that
helps build some sexual tension into the room that lasts with people even into adulthood.
I used to date somebody who was lifeguard at a leisure centre, and we definitely got up to all sorts of things that he probably would have been sacked for, involving his sack.
I'm sure that was just like Baywatch. Was it a leisure centre in Macclesfield?
It wasn't in Macclesfield. It was right. It was in Croydon, so more glamorous.
Well, international listeners should know that is just like Hawaii.
But that was such a formative experience for me that the smell of chlorine actually does make me think of sex.
Right.
And I've had a lot of wondrous holiday sex in various shower cubicles and washdown places after sexy nights at the beach.
And actually, a lot of people have experimented in the hotel, you know, spa pool, or, you know, in the sea. And maybe this is a way, isn't it, of taking it home?
Yeah, exactly. One of my favourite things to do is to get a partner in the shower when they're still wearing some clothes. When you've come in from a night out, just haul your... It's also a great way of sobering somebody up if you need to. But I think there's something really sexy about standing under the water. The hair gets wet, yours does. Your clothes cling to you more. They become semi-transparent and you can take each other's clothes off. If you want a hot twist on a striptease, get in the shower clothed or get your partner in there. Yes.
But for people who are going in the shower or the bath because their partner wants to and actually it doesn't do it for them, do you have any advice for them?
And there are a lot of women as well that find that, ironically, because there's so much moisture going on from the shower or the bath, that they're actually quite dry in their own down belows. And that's because the stream or the bath washes away their own natural lubricant. If that is an issue for you, try a little bit of silicone lubricant, because that tends to stick around longer in water. In fact, there are even varieties made specifically for use in the shower. Trojan make one called Riviera. Just be aware though, silicone lubricant is extremely slippery. So if you are adding that to an already slippery environment, you are going to want to take care.
And if we've got you all in a lather and you have a question of sex for Alex, what do you need to do with it?
Head on over to our website, which is modernmanwith2ends.co.uk, and hit feedback.
And something you can do in the cold light of day, you don't need to be locked away in a private wet room, is follow Alex on social media.
I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Alex Fox. That's A-L-I-X-F-O-X.
And with that, we've very nearly reached the end of this week's Modern Man, but there is just time to appoint a new ambassador. It is Stuart Baker, aged 48 and three quarters, from Yerevan in Armenia. He says, "My family's in the UK and I spend 50% of my time in Yerevan. Armenia is a beautiful country with lovely people, but there's nothing like being reminded of the delights of home. And Ollie, your friend next door, mischievous style, allows me to escape to the familiar land of pastures green and expensive beer. By the way, one beer in Britain is the cost of five in Yerevan." Well, Stuart, I am proud to appoint you ambassador for Yerevan. Congratulations. If you'd like to be a ambassador, just drop us a line, buy us a beer, or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Our music is by Django Django. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer Matt Hill, and we'll see you next Tuesday.